Vasilei. Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami iti namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Navasesha Sunyavadi Paskatya Desitarane. Is there anything can be done about this? Any otherwise voices? So, when trying to think how to present to you all in a logical way something of value about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, my first thought was to go through his life and then to speak about his teachings. But that seemed to be incomplete for the amount of time that we had. We had further time with which we could specialize on some particular aspects. So then on further thought, and then when I started to read about him, as I was mentioning this morning, I saw that he has four pranam mantras. You see here Srila Prabhupada's pranam mantras. Namaum Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami iti namane. So the first one is typical of any acharya can accept that pranam mantra by changing Bhakti Vedanta Swami to Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati or to the name of one's guru. And generally speaking, the second pranam mantra refers to some speciality of that particular personality. So we have here, Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvisesha Sunyavadi Paskatya Deshatarane. So Srila Prabhupada is known as the Paskatya Deshatarane. Paskatya Deshatarane means that he is the Atarani, the deliverer of the Paskatya Desh of the Westerners, Western countries. And he does that by delivering the Gauravani, the Vani, the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, Gauravani Prachar. He traveled throughout the Western countries and he taught and preached the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. And he did that as Saraswati Deve, Namaste Saraswati Deve, the servant of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So in Srila Prabhupada's first moments in arrival in America, he wrote two very, very powerful poems. And in one of them, he said, to begin his poem, he said, I emphatically say to you, O brothers, that you will receive the good fortune of Sri Krishna only when Srimati Radharani becomes pleased with you. And in another one, in the second poem, he wrote that it was by the divine desire of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who wanted the great saintly person, who wanted the message of Krishna to be spread throughout the whole world. And so it was he, Srila Prabhupada felt, who was doing this work. He was only lending his body, mind, heart, intelligence and so forth for Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur to perform the act which he wished, which was his very, very burning desire that the teachings of Lord Chaitanya should spread to all parts of the world. So when I looked at the pranam mantras of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, I discovered that there's not one and there's not two. I thought there were three, and then I saw that there weren't three, there were four. So when I saw that there were four, I thought, that's interesting, because there are two and two. And the first two, I will put this, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's picture up here, so I'll put one underneath after, but I have them here before me now. So the first one starts, Namaum Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale, same as Srila Prabhupada, Srimate Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati iti namane. This is a general. I offer my respectful obeisances unto His Divine Grace, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, who is very dear to Lord Krishna, having taken shelter of His lotus feet. So here we are hearing that Srila Prabhupada and before him Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had taken shelter of Krishna's lotus feet. So the second pranam mantra is interesting. Srivasha Banavi Devi Dayataya Kripabdaye Krishna Sambandha Vijnana Dayane Prabhave Namaha. This reads, I offer my respectful obeisances to Sri Varsha Banavi Devi Dayata Das,
What a long name he has. Some people get long names with two words or six syllables. But his name was Varshabhanavi, Sri Varshabhanavi Devi Dayata Das. This was the name that he was given by his very extraordinary avadhut spiritual master, Srila Gaurkishore Das Babaji Maharaj. Which means that he is the servant of Varshabhanavi Devi's Dayata, the beloved of Varshabhanavi Devi, which is Srimati Radharani. So he is servant of the beloved of Srimati Radharani, who is favored by Srimati Radharani and who is the ocean of transcendental mercy and the deliverer of the science of Krishna. So these are the first two. I'll read the second two and we will repeat them or hear them again tomorrow in the afternoon. The third one is Madhurya Ujjala Prema Dya Sri Rupanuga Bhaktida Sri Gora Karuna Shakti Vigrahaya Namostute. This reads in English. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you, the personified energy of Sri Chaitanya's mercy. What a powerful statement. The personified energy of Sri Chaitanya's mercy, who delivered devotional service, which is enriched with conjugal love of Radha and Krishna, coming exactly in the line of revelation of Srila Rupa Goswami. Then Namaste Gauravani Srimurtaye Dinatarane Rupanuga Varudapa Apasiddhanta Dwanta Harine. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you who are the personified teachings of Lord Chaitanya. You are the deliverer of all fallen souls and you do not tolerate any statement which is against the teachings of devotional service enunciated by Srila Rupa Goswami. Now in both of these second two pranam mantras, there are two names are mentioned in both of them. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Srila, yes, and Srila Rupa Goswami. And in the first pranam mantra, there is one name which is mentioned in both of them. No. What name is mentioned in both of them? In reference to Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Yes, Krishna. In the first one is saying he is very dear to Krishna and that he has taken shelter. He is the deliverer of the science of Krishna, having taken shelter at his lotus feet. In the second one it describes him as the personified energy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the personified teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and exactly in the line of Srila Rupa Goswami in both. So I thought that today what we should do is speak something about his preaching and teaching the science of Krishna. And tomorrow what we can do is hear something about how he was the personified teachings of Lord Chaitanya and he was following in the line of Srila Rupa Goswami. So if you can put this one just under the picture. So now another point that I was hoping that it may be possible like this. There. Like that, on that little ledge. Thank you. I was hoping that maybe I could share with you something that I experienced when I first was living for a few years in Vrindavan. At that time we had one devotee living there, his name was Rupa Vilas, is Rupa Vilas. And he used to give all the classes on the days of the appearances and disappearances of the previous acharyas. And I think that was when I developed my own personal enthusiasm for hearing from Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Because he would present a class, and the first half of his class he would go through the details of his life, which was very inspiring. Yet we would hear them as a sort of a historical, distant, exalted, wonderful personality. And then the second half of his class, he would present his teachings or words that came from his pen. And it was very interesting because that part I always liked very much because that part was very much available for me to apply in my own life. or try to. And as I said this morning, I noticed that sometimes when I would hear the uncompromising words of this great personality, they would sort of, they would make me kind of feel very uncomfortable. Because, as I said, he's uncompromising. He's 100% committed. And we ourselves, we're in a different category. In one place he explained that there are three types of living entities. There are living entities who are turned 100% to Krishna. There are living entities who are turned 100% away from Krishna. And there are those who are somewhat in the middle. And sometimes they turn to Krishna and sometimes they turn to matter. And I find that sometimes it's more difficult to preach to those people, which of course includes ourselves, than to turn to preach to the people who are diametrically with their back to Krishna. Because those people have nothing. They don't know anything about Krishna. If you can convince them of something, you can make some progress. But we, because we turn sometimes to Krishna, and then we turn away, and then of course we turn right back again, we sometimes fancy ourselves as more spiritually evolved than we truly are. We sometimes consider that we minimize the times we turn towards the world, and we maximize our remembrance of the times that we are turning very sincerely to Krishna. Or we turn to Krishna in difficulty. When things get very difficult, we immediately think, oh, Krishna, where is Krishna? I need him now. I need his help. And as soon as things get easy again, we think, thank you for that. That was very kind of you. I'm quite fine now. My life is running nicely. Thank you. I'll give you a ring next time I'm in need. And if you can just keep everything running nicely for me, I'd be extremely grateful. And I'll make sure that I do something for you also in exchange. And this tends to be the way that many religious people actually think. And so we're not very self-conscious. We don't see ourselves very well because we have enough bhakti, enough piety, to be classified as those pious people described in Bhagavad Gita and more. We've already decided that we want to give our life to Krishna. But these discrepancies, the parts that we keep behind us for ourselves only and not to be seen necessarily by others, these are the parts that are keeping us here within the world of matter. And an uncompromising person doesn't see anything of value in what we consider to be greatly valuable, so valuable that we can't afford to give that up. We put it over here, but we do our devotional activities and we keep this as well. And this includes, which puts a little bit of a lump in most of our throats, our family attachment, our love to our position within society in this world, our mind, our feelings, how I feel today, I feel like this, I feel like that. All of these things are included within the non-essential activities. Only, not by myself, of course, I have my own little store, but by those who are 100% transcendentalists. They class all of this as rubbish. So this is a little confronting, to say the least. So I was thinking I should like to share with you this confronting experience, and I hope that, and I don't mean this in a nasty sense, I hope that it's somewhat confronting for you also, but in an enlivening way, because I learned over years of hearing about this, hearing the words of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, that they have a penetrating effect. And what they do is they loosen up our worldliness, and they create clarity, spiritual clarity. And with that spiritual clarity, we can see the things that we possess in this world and use them in the service of Krishna, because ultimately they are not ours, but they're his. And this is a very important thing to understand. So, we are saying here that he is teaching the science of Krishna, or the science of pure devotional service. I will tell you another anatta that I have suffered from for years, because I have been reading Srila Prabhupada's books for a long time. I have come to a point, many years ago I came to this point, where my mind had sort of put everything onto the computer, so to speak, and it's felt like it understands everything now. And when I read certain sentences, it sort of just skims over them because I've heard them so much. I know what that means. I know what that means. And it doesn't feel challenged. And it doesn't feel as if it should stop and listen. I think, I'm familiar with that. I'm familiar with that. I do that already. I know that. And so tell me something new. And as we were hearing, Srila Prabhupada was writing to Jayananda in the letter this morning. He said, I have nothing new to tell you. I'm telling you the same thing. You must develop your love for Krishna, chanting, serving Krishna. So my mind, being materialistic, it turns these things and it says, yeah, I know that, I know that. And it passes without anything penetrating right through to the heart, to the essence. So when I read the words of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur or Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur, it comes from a different angle. And they always corroborate because they're doing exactly the same work. They're trying to wake up the dormant, sleeping souls in the material atmosphere. So hearing in new terms, new words from a different perspective tends to refresh my understanding of Srila Prabhupada. And then I find I go back to see, is that... that sounds new. Is that somewhere in Srila Prabhupada's written text? And I find that it is. And then it gives me a strength of faith that actually this is the absolute truth. So what is the science of Krishna? This is the first question. And Srila Rupa Goswami, it seems that Srila Rupa Goswami is very prominent here. So as we know, we have one book that Srila Prabhupada translated, Nectar of Devotion. And I remember when he translated that book, or when it was published, it was in 1970, and I had just joined the movement. I was very, very young and exuberant, and Srila Prabhupada had a small, very small movement then. He hadn't even gone outside of America at that stage, almost ready to go to England, or perhaps they had already gone to England, but he had not yet returned to India to preach. So everyone in the temple was given a book, and we each had a book, Nectar of Devotion. And every afternoon after lunch, we would sit down and we would read it. And so we would all sit around in the temple room, all the devotees in the Los Angeles temple, and everyone would read a paragraph. You had your own book, so you sit there and read a paragraph, the next person would read, and so on and so forth. I think that was to keep people awake. And so we would read. And Srila Prabhupada had given us a statement, because we were so brand new. I had only been a devotee 2 months when I got this book in my hand. And most of the people there were very similar in their level of maturity. So Prabhupada said, if you read this book and you have a question, read the book again. And then he said, and if you still have a question, then you read the book again. And when you have read this whole book 3 times, then you can ask a question. So because we didn't have the maturity to understand what he was trying to say by that, we developed at that time quite a superstitious idea about asking questions. For a long time, actually, no one would ask a question about Nectar of Devotion. If you asked a question, somebody would say, have you read the book 3 times? So it was like, it was a book that if you hadn't read it 3 times, you shouldn't really speak very much because it was for some mysterious reason. So it took many, many years later of reading and reading here and there to be able to understand what Srila Prabhupada was referring to. And it wasn't as some kind of an order of guru that you can only read this, ask a question after 3 readings. But he was trying to say that the subject matter is so very, very deep and it's so very extraordinary that there's no way that you will be able to understand the answer to a question unless you have very well acquainted yourself with the subject matter. If after reading for a few moments you say, what is this? You have none of the equipment, none of the conceptualizing, and none of the faith even to be able to receive the answer. So please, he's saying, continue to read and all the answers will come. So here in the introduction he describes, what is the authorized description of bhakti, the science of bhakti, or devotional service? He said it can be summarized in the following statement of Srila Rupa Goswami. First-class devotional service is known by one's tendency to be fully engaged in Krishna consciousness, serving the Lord favorably. The purport is that one may also be in Krishna consciousness unfavorably. So that's very interesting, that one can be in Krishna consciousness unfavorably. And Srila Prabhupada would tend to give an analogy, an example of this, and speak of somebody like King Kamsa, who was thinking of Krishna, but inimically. But we can see ourselves that someone can be in Krishna consciousness, but unfavorably. And why are they unfavorable? Because they do not have actually the purified devotion and the desire to be fully Krishna conscious. Pure devotional service should be free from the desire for any material benefit or for sense gratification. And these desires are cultivated, desire for personal benefit or sense enjoyment, through fruitive activities or philosophical speculation. Generally, people are engaged in different activities to get some material profit. So this includes ourselves. And most philosophers are engaged in proposing transcendental realization through volumes of word jugglery and speculation. Pure devotional service must always be free from such fruitive activities and philosophical speculation. One has to learn Krishna consciousness or pure devotional service from the authorities by spontaneous loving service. So this is quite mysterious. We learn devotional service from authorities by service. And not just by ordinary service, by self-benefiting service, but spontaneous loving service. So now let us move to some of the words of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. In his lifetime, he wrote many books. But at the end of his manifest pastimes in this world, there was some fighting took place within his institution. And at that time, I was told this by somebody who was informed, the volumes and volumes of literature that he had written, there was two contesting parties. So one party took all of the literature, and they were to cross the Ganga in a boat, and they placed all of the literatures of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, taking them across, and the boat sank. And so actually, if you want to find out what he has written, there's very, very few things available. There are some of his articles in The Harmonist, where he wrote in English, or it was a translation. There's a couple of his books, and the main thing that is available of his teachings is this book, which is presented by the Gaudiya Math, called Sri Chaitanya's Teachings. And in this Sri Chaitanya's Teachings, the English is very quaint. And this is almost all that is written by him that is available. So I was thinking of that when I sat down to read this book, that he spoke so much more, volumes and volumes more, and he wrote so much more. But this is what fate Krishna has given to us. This is all that we have received in our hands. And possibly this is all that we could actually assimilate, because he was speaking on a very high exclusive level at a different historical time, when the problems and the dilemmas that the living entities whom he was speaking to differed from our own. The primary aspect of what he speaks about in his teachings of Lord Chaitanya's teachings and the science of Krishna is that he's very, very cutting. He's cutting away at all the misconceptions. And many of the misconceptions that were faced by the people in those days are still very subtly or very really felt and faced by ourselves. But new ones are also there, and language has changed. And so therefore we approach Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur quite naturally, more easily, through Srila Prabhupada, who is presenting the same teachings to us. He's not giving anything different, but he's making those teachings available for the time, place and circumstances in which we are now living. But let us go to some of his words, bearing in mind the old Englishness and the poor English translation in different places, and that he speaks very strongly on social issues. Now, first of all, he speaks, so I'm going to, if you'll be patient with me, and I hope I will not become tedious for you. But I'm going to read different sections and speak a little bit about them so we can hear a few of the things that he says. So he talks about abandoning all non-absolute topics. He says, if we wish to associate ourselves with the absolute, all non-absolute propaganda for our temporary purposes should be abandoned as far as possible. Otherwise, we will be led to become materialists only. He uses this word a lot, absolute and non-absolute. Srila Prabhupada would use the supreme or transcendental or spiritual subject matter, but he preferred to use this term absolute and of this world non-absolute. The non-absolute propaganda will instigate us to entangle ourselves with worldly thoughts and ideas. We will be thinking of physical developments instead of associating ourselves with the absolute. Because we have shown diffidence means? Lack of confidence, sort of ambivalent, not so enthusiastic. Diffidence. We have proved our indolence for associating with him. Indolence means?
Laziness.
That's what I thought, laziness. Mm-hmm. So because we're not so enthusiastic about associating with the Supreme Personality, we have become somewhat lazy. So like shooting stars, we have been simply thrown off from him. We have rebelled against that entity. But now we should go back to him. Therefore, it is essential that all our associations and movements should tend to his service. So then he says that first of all, we should designate who he is. Who is this personality to whom we should serve? For whom we should give up so many things? We're so much, all of us, every one of us is very much interested in something or another in this world. And someone is coming and saying, you should give up all your worldly hearing and all your worldly interests to associate with the absolute. First of all, he should be designated. What is he? What form does he have? And how are we to go back to him? When we come to know that he keeps himself aloof from everything in this phenomenal world, we feel the necessity of associating with him. And this association can be had if we can eliminate the external impediments, which are like screens between the absolute infinity and the absolute infinitesimal. Our mental speculations are meant for associating with phenomenal objects only. Everything has come out of him and everything will go back to him, and everything is meant for his service. All animate and inanimate objects have come out of him, and they are meant for his service only. This is the perspective of somebody who is 100% turned towards the absolute. They see that everything here, that means everything, everyone, everything, all the thoughts, all the gross, all the subtle, everything, all the elements, they all come from him and they all belong to him. This is the person who we are meant to serve. It is not a limited, he uses the word crippled idea. He said you should not have a crippled idea of God. So when we were having one discussion on this subject, and I had with some devotees, and I asked them, what do you think it means to have a crippled idea? And they gave different answers. And it was interesting because I knew them all the devotees who were there, small group. And each thing they said, I knew that that was the particular thing that they have a difficulty with. You know, somebody said, a crippled idea means that you feel like he can't take care of you. God can't take care of you. So this is a crippled idea. It means that why should you turn to a God who can't take care of you? And somebody else said, a crippled idea means that I can control him. You know, I think if I do this and do that, he has to give me things so I can control him, so he's not really so potent. And somebody else said, a crippled person, they kind of walk with a limp, you know, they're not very dynamic. So a crippled God, somebody he's not very... And somebody else said, a very, very obscure idea of God. When somebody just thinks, God, he's something misty and foggy and very ethereal. So I have a practical life to lead. And somebody else said, he's not practical, you know, he's not meaningful. I've got to do things and he doesn't answer my, and so forth. So when I was listening, I was thinking, yes, these are crippled ideas, and we all have our own limited ideas. He says, we should have a peep into the truth, and that truth must be reached. If we are sincere, he will expose himself to our vision. Whatever we do, we should do it for him, for his eternal purpose, instead of indulging ourselves in transitory transactions. We should not be the recipients of the fruit of the enterprises we have. It is better for us that whatever we do should be done in his favor for his service. We are servitors. We should make it a point that all our activities should tend to his service. All animate and inanimate beings have emanated from him. We should serve the Absolute and not engage ourselves in the non-Absolute. So does this mean if we have to be a servant, we have to give everything up? In very many places, Srila Prabhupada emphatically, even Lord Chaitanya said, no, you do not have to give everything up, but you have to find the relevance of everything to the service of Krishna. And if you do not do this, then your service, even though you're performing activities, it will not be pleasing to Krishna to the degree that you are capable of, if you do not see everything as actually his. You can just imagine if I came in here and the room was empty and I started taking the things, there were a few nice pieces of furniture, and I started thinking, well, I'll take this, I could use this in my room, and I start putting them all in the van outside and I start helping myself to things. The person, people who were on ownership of the place, they would be very disturbed by my activities. Even though I'm here, but I'm thinking I can take this, I can use this, I can do this, I can do this. And actually these things belong to somebody else. So this is one of the very important points that he makes, that things belong to somebody else. Now, he says something here that's also very important. Because sometimes we might feel a little uncourageous about the attempt to take up such a rigidly absolute point of view. He says, when we are inhabitants of this world, how, after fully relinquishing our experience about it, can we take refuge of a supermortal being? Here's our question. If we live here, how can we relinquish the things of this world and take shelter of this extraordinary supermortal beyond our understanding? In answer, it is said that it will do no good to get afraid of the difficulty. To know the truth, there should be a great strength of mind. You will not learn how to swim if, after seeing the water, you become afraid. Self-surrender is not a very difficult thing. Rather, it is very natural and easy for the soul. Whatever is contrary to self-surrender is actually unnatural and difficult. So this again involves a shifting, a turning around of our consciousness, because we may be thinking, this sounds very difficult, and he's saying, this is not difficult. Everything else is difficult. The things you're experiencing in your life are difficult. The problems of this world are difficult, but surrendering to Krishna is a very simple and natural thing. It is natural for the soul. And then, of course, we should ask ourselves, then why is it seem so difficult to me? If you're saying it's easy, it's natural, why does it seem so difficult? He says, if you want to learn about God, you will have to learn from his agent. When we listen to him, we must stop all our experience about the world and all misleading arguments. It is by continually listening to the strong and forceful narrations about God's glories that all the evils, like that of weak-heartedness, will be liquidated, and there will appear instead an unprecedented courage in the heart. Then will arise in its full glow self-surrender, which is the natural virtue of the soul. And this will reveal, and then will reveal itself in that self-surrendered heart, the self-manifested truth of the transcendental region of the fourth dimension. Now I'd like to share with you something about this concept that he is giving here about a fourth dimension. Because we know the world has three dimensions, right? We have three-dimensional objects. But he speaks very often using this term, the fourth dimension. So I'll just see if I can find a quote that will help us to understand that. This was something I was reading when I was preparing, and then I started to think about this, and I suddenly got a kind of an insight into something that I had never thought of before. He says, the position of Godhead, God, is all round. That means he can see everywhere simultaneously at the same time. He's omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. So his position is all round. We have only two eyes. We see only half of the horizon. If we're looking up and we can't see down. We're looking down, we can see down and we can't see up. And I was thinking, because we look around, we have a mobility in our neck. We're not actually aware of how limited we are. Because I'm looking over here, I hear a noise over there, I look over there. So I have this facility to be able to turn. But in actuality, at any given time, I can only see a very small amount. But because I move very quickly, I think I can see a lot. We were hearing this about chanting also, that please try to chant and listen to one mantra and not think ahead in the mind, oh, and now I'll chant two mantras and now I'll chant all day like this, I'm a very good chanter. So many thoughts that come flowing into the mind, try to avoid them and try to concentrate now on what you're able to hear now, because at this one moment, our mind is going racing ahead or racing back, but the only freedom we have is in this particular moment. This one tiny moment, and then the next, and then the next, and then the next. And so much of the time the mind is racing ahead and racing back, and justifying things, and planning things, and thinking about things, and going on and on and on, and the present, to try to keep your mind, your consciousness, right now where you are, becomes an extremely difficult exercise for a conditioned soul because the mind is racing. So similarly, our eyes can move very, very quickly, but actually they only see a certain amount of anything. He says, we only have two eyes and we see only half of the horizon. Look up at the sky. We look up at the sky, but you cannot see then on the ground. We cannot see the other half unless there is rotation. When a globular sphere is considered, we can only see a quarter of the globe, as in this mundane world. So far as the sphere is considered, only one fourth is shown to us, but we can calculate from the sight of one quarter. There are the first, second, third, and fourth quadrants. So he's saying you can see one quarter. This whole material world he's referring to as one quarter, not just our little gazing, but he's using for our own understanding how our eyes can only see a certain amount. Similarly, when we know, if we knew everything in the whole material world is one quarter only. So then the person who was listening to him, he asked him, how can you get super mundane realization? How can you go beyond that? He says, knowledge of the first dimension is acquired first. That means to understand this world properly. Before you go any further, all mental speculation should cease. All forms of service to Godhead are meant for Godhead, mean that our mind should first of all be controlled. The mind is busy picking up ideas and thoughts from this world. If they are carried to the spiritual world, there it would be anthropomorphic. There is no such attribution to Godhead. So we have to first of all understand this world properly, then we can understand the dimensions beyond this world. which are the dimensions in which, as he explains, we actually exist, because we are spirit, we are not meant to stay within the material world. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, as I told you, was very busy criticizing things. But his criticisms were very profound. Let me read you one of a more modern nature. But do remember that he's speaking in 1920. He's not speaking today. And surely if he was speaking today, he would have even more to say. Just a moment. The term commercialism perhaps best expresses the typical method of the immediate modern age. Everything is being rapidly and visibly commercialized. The nation that possesses the strongest commercial organizations and capacity is also the most successful in the struggle for all-round, efficient international existence. Nothing, however, is so easy nowadays as the manufacture of experts. And civilization is being made in turn by the experts in the laboratories. Nothing that will sell can be made except with the help of the most up-to-date workshop. Nations judge one another's civilization by the respective sizes of the focal lengths of the biggest and smallest telescopes and other scientific appliances in their possession. The mechanical help is all important. The more one is able to spend on it, the greater one's resulting efficiency, goodness, health, beauty, and whatnot in this purely commercial age. Good looks, good health, strength, a good voice, a charming landscape, everything worth having is prospected for being turned to its full commercial use. So this we see is so rampant, and it will just continue because this is the term best expressing the typical method of the modern age. Then he will tell you something about the ugliness of this world. There cannot be a well-imagined greater shock to the sense of beauty than the attempt to deck a corpse. The endeavor to decorate the things of this world by means of our mundane resources is very similar to the attempt to beautify a dead body. The result is a foregone conclusion. Our aesthetic favorite of this moment is discarded at the next in favor of others, who are also replaced by others in their turn. The king, who lives in the most costly style, has no more liking for his showy splendors of his royal state when they are not renewed than the pauper has for his old tattered rags. Familiarity breeds contempt for all things of this world on account of their inherent ugliness, which is found out on actual contact. So this is, he's speaking in this section on aesthetics and explaining that actually all the aesthetics of man, the art and the music and the everything, is dedicated towards something to do with the body, the mind and the body. And the mind and the body are external to the soul, and they're inherently not satisfying. So he speaks very strongly. Now, I'll read you another one that I found myself of his thoughts that was very, very strong for myself as a devotee. It made me sort of wonder about my ability to speak. And then I decided something which I will share with you later. This is his vision of somebody who is a preacher, how they should be, somebody who is a serious preacher. A chanter of the Kirtan of Hari is necessarily the uncompromising enemy of worldliness and hypocrisy. So this, when I read this, I sort of thought, maybe I won't read this. I turned to the next one, I thought, like, maybe I could tone that down, and then I could see, wow, you know, how easy it is to think like that. Well, you know, we can't really do this. And you know, if you talk like this to people, you turn them away. If you said, you know, everything, I'm an uncompromising enemy of everything worldly that you are doing, people would be offended. And practically speaking, this was what Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur did. When people would be brought to him by his big preachers who were preaching in India, big men, influential people, he was an uncompromising enemy of worldliness and hypocrisy, and he would immediately speak to them in uncompromising terms. And it said, Srila Prabhupada said that some of his preachers were embarrassed to bring people to him. They didn't have faith. And they wouldn't bring because they knew he would cut this person down and the person may be offended. And Srila Prabhupada said, those who thought like that fell down. Because this is the truth. And then when I noticed the part of my mind that felt uncomfortable with being uncompromising, I was thinking, yes, that is the part of the mind that one time somebody told me you should understand that the mind is not a devotee. The mind is a non-devotee. And this is our challenge, is to make that mind become actually devotional. As chanting of the kirtan of Hari, it is the constant function to dispel all misconceptions by the preaching of the truth in the most ambiguous form without any respect for person, place or time. Just imagine how strong he was. It is his bounden duty to oppose clearly and frankly any person who tries to deceive and harm himself and other people by misrepresenting the truth due to malice or a bona fide misunderstanding out of ignorance or out of some ulterior motive. He should be challenged and corrected. This will be possible if the chanter of kirtan is always prepared to submit to be trodden on by thoughtless people, if any discomfort to himself will enable him to do good to his persecutors by chanting the truth in the most ambiguous manner. Now here is the quality of heart that one needs to do this. Because when Srila Prabhupada was in our presence, he would speak, call everyone rascals and fools. You can see any time you see a video or listen to a lecture, he's this rascal and this rascal. And so we were young and it was very easy to go out and call people rascals, and he would call them kamis and so many strong words, and we would call them the same. And one time he said, I can call them rascals and fools because I'm elderly, but you cannot. But we did anyway, and we went out and we were feeling uncompromising. We would call people all sorts of things, but we didn't have this quality of heart that is being described here, that he's always prepared to be trodden on by those who misunderstand him when he speaks unambiguously. And can anyone think what's the most vivid example of somebody who was prepared to do that? No, somebody of more in our Western religious culture. Jesus. Yes, he was prepared. He was prepared to be killed, basically, by the people who were not going to understand him, and still he was prepared to speak and to speak uncompromisingly. And because he had that strength, that purity and strength, even though many of his followers may not live up to the standard of his teachings, over time this can happen, but his teachings remain spread throughout the whole world. If you think, even if you think superficially, how many millions and billions of people consider themselves followers of Jesus Christ? Even if they're poor followers, they consider themselves followers. So many people, because of his power to be prepared to speak uncompromisingly and show the example of not only being trodden on, but if you read the accounts of his preaching, you see that he triumphed over over death, and he triumphed over all the misunderstandings of a very violent circumstance without any fear. And one time I remember somebody asked Srila Prabhupada when we were in Melbourne, did Jesus Christ feel any pain? And Srila Prabhupada said, no, He was a mystic yogi. He did not feel any pain. He did not. He was so great. He was so uncompromising. He was beyond the material body. And therefore he appeared again in person. His disciples were able to see him. And he could even show them in his transcendental form the marks on his hands when they could not believe that he was still present with them. And so from his example, so much power has come into the world. So this is what one actually has to be prepared to do if one wants to be a bona fide chanter of the names of Hari. If he is unwilling or afraid of considerations of self-respect or personal discomfort to chant the kirtan under all circumstances, then he's unfit to be a preacher of the absolute truth and no sympathy for untruth. A person who entertains any potentiality for untruth is unfit to chant the kirtan of Hari. Any clinging to untruth is opposed to the principle of humility born of absolute submission to the truth. Those who serve the truth at all times by means of all their faculties have no hankering for the trivialities of this world and are always necessarily free from malice born of competing worldliness and are therefore fit to admonish those who are actively engaged in harming themselves. So only a powerful transcendentalist can speak like this because he has 100% nothing to do, no interest in this world. There's nothing that he will profit from his words. He just has come for the purpose of enlightening others. So he is fit to admonish those who are actively engaged in harming themselves and others by the method of opposing or misrepresenting the truth, in order to attain the rewards of such a policy in the shape of perpetuation of the state of misery and ignorance. The method which is employed by the servant of the good preceptor for preventing such misrepresentation of the truth is a part and parcel of the truth itself. So I would like to read you another one about the spiritual and how different it is from this world here that we know. This is a different subject. The order of my preceptors has told me many things in a very beautiful way. I would, however, state a few essential things for their acceptance. We have no other function except throwing ourselves on the protection of God. We must not consider God to be the caretaker of our garden. It is not our desideratum to attend only to our present day needs. Our primary basic purpose is the service of Hari. We must always walk in that path on which we shall be fully provided with the service of Krishna. May we never perform any activity being deprived of the service of the servants of God. If we do not employ all secular knowledge, all history, all literature, philosophy, science, the arts of wars and politics in its proper sense, or in other words, if we do not fully connect everything with the reference to Krishna, that is to reduce it to the service of Godhead, it would give rise to the controversial method which would make us think that we should give up this thing and that thing and not that it is not this and that it is not this and not that. What he's speaking of here is very important. He's saying, if we don't connect everything to Krishna, we'll think, I have to give this up. Maybe I can't give it up. Maybe I should give it up. I don't know this is not so good. Maybe it's all right. We'll go backwards and forwards, and our understanding of spiritual will become negative. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this. But we want to actually connect everything to Krishna in such a way that our understanding of spiritual life is very, very strongly positive and whole. And that means that everything here, everything we do, everything we can see is His. And in that sense is Him. But not only that, He exists beyond this material, designated material world. And our only real business should be to try to find out how we can find Him and love Him. I would like to also read something he has written here about transcendental sound. This is another subject that I found myself, when I was reading his works, at first I found it quite baffling, because all we know is material sound. So when we chant Krishna's name, we just treat Krishna's name, the holy name, and the glories of hearing the pastimes of the Lord, we treat it in the same way out of unconsciousness as we treat material sound. So material sound, you verify everything. It can be verified with your senses. You can hear something and you want to verify that. You go and check if you accept it. You check in so many different ways. But transcendental sound is of a different quality, and it cannot actually be verified, because it is not under the control of our mind or our intelligence or our senses. It comes from another dimension. And this is something that it leaves us, at least I would say for myself, sort of with a blank. Because I can understand things of this world, I can verify them, I can check, I can look up on the internet and find out so much information. I can become equipped with knowledge of this world, but the transcendental sound vibration is different. So for understanding of that difference, we have to hear the names of Krishna. The holy name of Krishna is not a fabrication of the human brain, like other names current among the nations that refer to things of this world. So many languages, so many words. There are no doubt also epithets of Godhead that are coined by man. People say things, I think God's like this, I believe God's like that, God's this, God's that. Such epithets need not be classed with the real names. The names Vishnu, Krishna, etc. are the eternal names of Godhead. As such, they are identical with the form, quality, activity, and paraphernalia of the Absolute. The holy name of Godhead possesses this additional power by the will of Godhead, that He, the holy name is referred to as a person here, as He, because Krishna and His name are non-different. Amina tvam nami namino. The nam, the name, and the namina, namini, the person whose name, they're the same. Everything here is not like that. If I say, I want a drink of water, that means someone will have to go and get a drink of water, or I'll have to place my hand somewhere to a cup and drink the substance. The name and the substance, they're different. We can change the name of the water. The object, water, we can call it by so many different languages, different names. But all those names are created from the mind of man. And the object, water, and the name, the language it is spoken, they're distinct from each other. They're separate entities. But Krishna, by way of His being absolute, Krishna and His name are the same. So when we chant Krishna's name, it's like the sun in the sky. The sun is so brilliant and bright. There may be many clouds covering the vision of those who are looking upwards, and they may consider that the sun is covered. But Krishna's name is like the sun, and it is never to be covered. From His perspective, His name cannot be covered. But from our perspective, being infinitesimally small, we can become covered by the influence of Maya. And then what should we do? Does that mean that we cannot approach Krishna in the form of His name? No, it means that when we chant His name, we are chanting and chanting and chanting and chanting, and gradually the clouds and the mists are compared to ignorance and material conceptions. And these gradually will clear. And as they clear, as the clouds clear, you begin to be able to see that the sun is very brilliant and bright. The holy name of Godhead possesses this additional power by the will of Godhead, that he is the first to appear in this world to the truth-seeking cognitive faculty of the soul, who is not satisfied with worldliness. The spiritual nature of the holy name and his descent into the purified consciousness of the sincere seeker of the truth is the only means of spiritual enlightenment revealed by the scriptures that are available to us. The holy name in the form of the word or spoken sound belongs to the realm of the absolute. The holy name of Godhead himself is the source of all cognition. The holy name is Godhead himself, who is the source of all cognition of the individual soul of man, derivative conditioned by the will of the source. Is derivative and conditioned by the will of the source. So the holy name is the source of our cognition, our power to understand something. And we are conditioned now not to understand by the source of the holy name or the holy name himself. The limitation of human cognition is willed by the source of that cognition. And deliverance from limitation also proceeds from the same quarter. So as we become not satisfied with worldliness, and we chant in that way, I'm not satisfied, like a child. If we leave a child in this room and we all go off for a nice long walk, very soon the child will not be satisfied in the room. And if we lock all the doors, soon they will be banging on the doors and crying very loudly. And when somebody hears the child, then they will let them out of the room because they can see the child's distress and difficulty. But if we think it would be easier for us to go for our walk and not take the children, and so we place them in here with a lot of toys, and they become quite happy playing with all the toys, then we peep in the window and they're coloring nicely, they're going on with all the things in the room, then we can go and take our walk and we can be peaceful and they will be peaceful also. So when we're happy to be in this material world within a situation that actually can never really give us happiness, but we're satisfied that all the distractions of the world are what I want, then when we are in that situation, then Krishna does not appear to us with full potency in his holy name because we are already satisfied. But when we become very much unsatisfied with what we see and know of this world, when we identify that our problem is being within the material world, rather than our problem is some difficulty with one person, difficulty with another person, difficulty with one situation, difficulty with this, difficulty with that, because one difficulty after another approaches us. When we identify more deeply, we go beyond the superficial or the surface and we see where the difficulty is coming from. And why is it so constant? We solve one problem by creating another. We get relief when we're carrying a big load. We can put it on our shoulder and carry it for some time, but it starts to ache. And then we can put it in our arms. I remember when I was a young mother and had to carry a little baby, and it was uncomfortable to carry him on the hip. Try on the other hip, put him like this, then try something else over the shoulders. But every time I would still feel the same weight. Whatever the weight of the child, eventually that weight would bother on my shoulders, on my hip, on my arms. So this is how it is in the material world. The difficulties, we shift them from place to place. But the reality is that the difficulty is being here at all. And this is what is being told. Okay, I will read one more and then I want to just share one other thought with you. It is as if he is choosing the things that I'm reading because I had set up a different order, and then when you sit down to speak, all of a sudden different ones come and you have to be prepared to accept them. So he says here, this is a training place. In this place we are liable to suppose that everything is meant to serve us. But the real truth is that we are meant to serve Godhead in one of five different capacities. It is only when we deem it fit to come down to this world to lord it over the other finite entities for our enjoyment, that our real position happens to be forgotten to some extent. This contingency arises when we want to deprive our Lord. That tendency was innate within us. This is a very interesting point, which he also speaks about. When we try to enjoy ourselves, we are depriving Krishna of his enjoyment. And that is why we are considered to be offenders. And that is why the material energy is very, very firmly binds us and keeps us in a prison-like condition. Because we are naturally meant to give him pleasure. And when we seek our own pleasure, at that moment, we're not interested in giving him pleasure. We're interested in seeking pleasure for ourselves. So this becomes the predicament. That tendency was innate with us. It led us to prefer this temporary region by our own desire. These entanglements will slowly be removed when the true suggestion will come to us on our meeting with persons who are aware of our interest. We should be prepared to hear how we can live a peaceful life and aspire after eternal bliss from the Absolute who can give it. But unless we submit to Him, there is no possibility of getting to that eternal region. If we do otherwise, we would be multiplying speculations that would only become disadvantages. Now the point that I was interested in sharing with you about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was something that I read when I was reading another of his writings, not this book, where he was glorifying his father, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I beg your pardon. And it is said that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, his only real aim in life, the thing he was most interested in and he was most dedicated to, was teaching, presenting the teachings of his father, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And so he was printing and preaching and doing everything on his behalf. And at the end of his life also, he made the comment that the line of Bhaktivinoda will never be closed. That means he was preaching on behalf of his father. So he says about his own father, Thakur Bhaktivinoda has been specifically kind to unfortunate people who are engrossed in mental speculations of all kinds. This is the people that he was kind to. So that sort of sounds a little like us. People who are engrossed in mental speculations of all kinds. And why are we engrossed in mental speculations? Mental speculations are the result of not knowing the truth. If you know the truth, then you know the truth. If you don't know the truth, then you will be speculating. I think it could be this, I think it might be that. And if you are very wise, you might make a very elaborate attempt to understand something. But without no knowledge of the truth, then all you will be busy doing is making your own ideas. So generally, this is a position that is criticized by a transcendentalist. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur was very kind to these people. And if you read some of his books, I think there's one book, Sri Chaitanya Shikshamritam, which our Bhanu Swami has translated and is available also in another translation as well. If you read his writings, you'll see that he very carefully and elaborately explains everything very simply of the science of Krishna in like a textbook form. So that a person who is doubtful, who is critical, who is atheistic, when they read his writings, they're very systematically presented. This is the present malady of the present age, this mental speculation. Other acharyas who appeared before Bhaktivinoda did not address their discourses directly to the empiric thinkers. They had been more merciful to those who are naturally disposed to listen to discourses on the Absolute without being dissuaded by arguments of avowed opponents of Godhead. So in previous times, the acharyas, they were kind to the people who were submissive and had a natural inclination towards hearing the truth. But as Kali Yuga progresses and everything goes downward, Lord Chaitanya's mercy appears in very, very clear form. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur spoke for those people who were doubtful. Then we hear from Srila Prabhupada how Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, his speciality was something different. He spoke very uncompromisingly to break some of the cultural boundaries and conditions that were being applied in India to the teachings of Krishna, the science of Krishna, and opened the doors to the Westerners and allowed Westerners to enter. But basically, he didn't speak very much, a little he did, but not very much to Westerners themselves. So his teachings are very high and uncompromising. The truth is not being changed. The presentation alters according to the individual time and place. But then I was thinking how Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was saying that the person who is a preacher, they must be absolute. They must be completely pure. But we see that we're asked to preach and teach when we first join, even after moments of becoming a devotee. We're asked to assist Srila Prabhupada in his teaching and preaching. And we can see that we are not of that quality. So this becomes the speciality of Srila Prabhupada. What was meant to be only handed to those who had the power to be able to speak uncompromisingly and purely, he has handed into the hands of anyone and everyone who is prepared to help spread the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. So this is really very amazing. This is an extraordinary gift that he gives us this opportunity. But, on the other hand, we should understand very seriously that if we do not improve in coming to this point of pure devotion, constant engagement in devotional service, and give up the worldly sides of our natures, then we will not become very high quality preachers of the truth. And we will not be able to effect the type of revolutionary changes that Srila Prabhupada was speaking of and he wanted. And so many of the things he wanted, practically speaking, we haven't been able to do them. You could probably make a long list of the things that haven't actually taken place. I remember when we were in Gita Nagari in 1976, and Srila Prabhupada was speaking about farm communities, how there should be thriving farm communities all over the world, and that these farm communities should be a place where there are so many devotees bringing up their children, you know, outside of the modern social setup, where everybody is interested in materialism, and these children should be brought up in this way, and the family should live in this way, and they should cultivate the land. And at Gita Nagari, he said, you should have so many cows, you should do this, you should do that, you should have gurukulas, and the children will turn out first-class preachers, and there will be no question of them becoming materialistic in any way, because they will have had this training from the very beginning of their lives. And so many things one can quietly muse on that they had not actually taken place in the way that he said. So we can only take that as being due to the fact that we do not necessarily yet carry the full potency that we will carry as individuals and as society were we to become willing to be uncompromisingly Krishna conscious, and not to retain our own sense of our own personal needs and our own personal selfishness. That does not mean that we would become robotic and we would have no life of our own. It means actually quite the opposite. We would actually gain our spiritual life. He says, Thakur Bhaktivinoda's greatest gift to the world consists in this, that he has brought about the appearance of those pure devotees who are at present carrying on the movement of unalloyed devotion to the feet of Sri Krishna by their own whole-time spiritual service of the divinity. So we should wish to serve them whole-time, to serve them who are whole-time serving Krishna. And by doing this, great benefit will be ours. Okay, Shiva, what time do we stop? Alright. Okay. Alright, so thank you very much for patiently listening. And tomorrow I will prepare a few more quotes teaching in regards specifically to the teachings of Lord Chaitanya and also the significance of being a follower of Srila Rupa Goswami. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.